Humans have actually been using fungi for like thousands of years. There's actually an amazing story of a human that was found in the Swiss Alps called Ötzi, and he's like, he's thousands of years old now, but he was found frozen in the Swiss Alps, and he was found with two different types of fungi on him. One that was thought to be medicinal, is used often for antiseptic and antibacterial sort of plasters, and one that he probably was using for tinder to make fires because it was so cold. And so, yeah, just to say that the sort of relationship that humans have with fungi has been going on for thousands of years, and this is not something new. This is something that we've been relying on for a long time.
Hi, I'm Robin, and this is Beneath the City is Soil, a journey into the future of today, a collection of conversations with humans engaged in worldbuilding projects, rehearsals of human and ecological flourishing emerging from the decomposing matter of a late capitalist system that has set our world on fire. Part 2. Land as Kin. Maimuna Arafen is an artist, community organiser, writer and the founder of Fungi Futures. It was a crisp, wintry afternoon as we sat down and recorded this interview online from our homes.
I'm Maimuna Arafen. I'm an artist and a community organiser and a writer based in London. I come from a Bangladeshi diaspora background, so my family histories are really rooted in farming and weaving and making. And so those sort of relationships to land and craft are something that sit really at the heart of everything I do now as part of my practice. I would say my practice moves between like art and ecology and also community care and activism. So I work a lot with fungi and with soil and plants, but I also work with textiles and found materials in my art practice. So often I kind of gravitate towards things that already carry stories. So I use a lot of materials that I feel hold sort of richness in terms of the relationships they have with humans, like clay and textiles. I'm really interested in what living systems can sort of teach us about interdependence and mutual aid and survival in a world that I feel like is becoming increasingly sort of shaped by extraction and disconnection. In 2020, I founded a project called Fungi Futures, which is a community project where I offer accessible fungi walks and workshops and really sort of communal learning spaces. And these are always just very slow and grounded sort of invitations for people to reconnect with the natural world and think more about fungal ways of being and think about how we can live differently together. So yeah, I would say at its core, my practice is about paying attention and slowing down and thinking about what's happening underground and what's happening between us and allowing that to really shape the kinds of futures that we want to make possible.
Central to Maimuna's work is her fascination for fungi. In 2021, during the COVID-19 pandemic, she published her award-winning master's thesis, Mapping Alternative Futures Through Fungi, The Usefulness of Mycorrhizal Networks as a Metaphor for Mutual Aid, which was recommended to me by a close friend. The vital role of fungi in our ecosystems is now widely known, and we are seeing research exploring their uses as plastic decomposers, as the foundation of alternative materials, and for the treatment of mental health illnesses. But Maimuna's work also looks at our interdependence and what the fungal world can teach us.
A lot of my work now is related to fungi, and I did not see that as a career path, I'll be honest. But my relationship with fungi, it was born out of the COVID-19 lockdowns. And this was a time, I think, that was really marked by such a profound sense of collective grief and really sort of disorientation. And when I think back to it, there was this real sort of quiet underlying existential dread because no one really knew what was going on. And it was like many people, my world had just very suddenly shrunk and the days were kind of blurring into each other. And so I just say this as context because it's from this sort of quite a bleak landscape that I started to notice on my daily walks these fungi. And As I'm sure many people know, mushrooms just come in such weird, all sorts of shapes and sizes and colours, and I just found myself becoming really sort of hypnotized and entranced by them. I was actually at the time training in horticulture, so I was learning a lot about plants and botany, but I wasn't learning very much at all about fungi, and so it felt like a part of the curriculum that was sort of neglected, and I wanted to take that into my own hands once I started noticing these mushrooms pushing through the leaf litter and clinging to tree trunks and sometimes appearing just overnight. I felt really drawn into their world, and I started to just kind of deep dive into what the fungi could teach me, and the curiosity sort of, yeah, just became, it really spiraled, to be honest. And every day I would be going on these walks and seeing what mushrooms I could find, and I was actually just taking photos and then looking at these online forums. I was finding these forums that had photos and trying to match them with what I had seen outside, so it was very nerdy of me, and I don't think I realized how much I would be spending time on these random corners of the internet. What began as a form of escapism rather became a form of listening and a sort of exercise of thinking about what was hidden beneath the soil and what sort of quiet, unseen labour was happening to make all of life above ground possible. I now try and really learn with fungi rather than just thinking about learning from them and kind of taking from them. I try to think more in reciprocal ways about care and community and what the fungi can teach us. Fungi, I feel like they really haven't had enough attention. I think they're finally getting more sort of credit in the mainstream, but we are still very much, I think, only on the tip of the iceberg. And that does really excite me, actually, because I think we didn't know for a long time much more than fungi just being decomposers. And now there's a whole other sort of class of fungi that are being a bit better understood in recent years. So there's a group of fungi that are called mycorrhizal fungi, and myco just means mushroom and rhiza means root. And so mycorrhizal fungi are the ones that connect with plant roots. And basically fungi often grow with a sort of root-like structure that's called mycelium. And the mycelium can connect with loads of different plant roots, often of different plant species, and connect them all together. So this basically creates what some ecologists now call the wood wide web, which is sort of a play on the world wide web, the internet. And it's this huge interconnected system that supports soil life and really allows, in some cases, plants to communicate with each other, to send sort of messages to each other if there's a threat in the environment, to redistribute resources. If a tree is very unwell, then it might send a chemical signal to a nearby plant via the wood wide web and say, hey, I need some help. And the fungi might help to redistribute some nutrients and water from other plants to that particular plant that's in need. So this discovery or understanding that we now have about mycorrhizal fungi has really changed the way that we see fungi, because this was something that's been happening for thousands of years and we just had no idea. And so it's kind of amazing to, when you realize how many different parts of human life fungi are involved in. If you think about the other type of class of fungi, which is the decomposers, even what they're doing, we kind of learn it in school sometimes, but I think we sort of take it for granted that actually fungi are breaking down all of the dead plants, the wood, the leaves, even animal matter, and they're using these powerful enzymes to then turn what's all of these nutrients that are locked up in particular compounds, and they're unlocking them so that they're available for living organisms to then use again, and kind of allowing these cycles of life to continue. So I do find it quite amazing when you think about fungi as these transformers that can turn dead matter into the components of life again. And I do think that they deserve more credit than they often receive, because without fungi, then plants wouldn't exist, and plants obviously feed animals, and animals are humans, so we really do need them to keep us alive. Often this work that fungi is doing is so invisible that I think this invisibility really matters, and it kind of reminds us that some of the most important life support systems are taking place out of sight and without recognition or reward or acknowledgement. So yeah, whenever I'm teaching others about the role of fungi in the ecosystem, I try and remind people that they really deserve their flowers. Humans have actually been using fungi for like thousands of years. There's actually an amazing story of a human that was found in the Swiss Alps called Ötzi, and he's like, he's thousands of years old now, but he was found frozen in the Swiss Alps, and he was found with two different types of fungi on him. One that was thought to be medicinal, is used often for antiseptic and antibacterial sort of plasters, and one that he probably was using for tinder to make fires because it was so cold. And so yeah, just to say that the sort of relationship that humans have with fungi has been going on for thousands of years, and this is not something new. This is something that we've been relying on for a long time, whether it's in fermentation of like bread and beer and wine, or our world's medicines as well, like producing antibiotics.
In Maimana's research, she quotes organiser and legal academic Dean Spade. I reflect on what happens when we take a moment to breathe, to step outside and to truly listen. For it is in these moments of gentle contemplation and stillness for ourselves that I believe we learn how to truly show up for others. I asked Maimana why this resonated and how it relates to her practice today.
It's something, even though I completed my research quite a few years ago now, it's something that I keep coming back to, this sort of central thesis, which was, I think I often now look to fungi as almost like a living mirror of the worlds that we want to build, and what can we sort of learn from fungi that can teach us about ourselves and how to live in sort of more just and reciprocal ways with each other. Because I guess what's important to say as a caveat is that there are so many different types of fungi. Some are parasitic and some move towards the end of the spectrum that's more mutualistic and symbiotic. The fungi that I was looking into were mycorrhizal fungi, which, as I've already explained with the Wood Wide Web, is the sort of more mutualistic end of fungi. The sort of research that I was doing was looking into the vast underground networks of mycelium that connect with plant roots, and how this can really be a metaphor for our deep interconnectedness with each other, and also our dependence on one another for things like mutual aid and care in times of need and in times of difficulty. And so I think when I say in my research that this is a metaphor, it really is kind of beyond a metaphor, because what is happening under the soil is, in very literal terms, helping the whole forest to survive through these interconnections. And so I was looking in my research about what if we as humans kind of thought about ways to organize with each other that weren't hierarchical or kind of extractive from one another, but instead could be sort of responsive and mutual and shared sort of power dynamics rather than hierarchical ones, where we can then, yeah, just embody sort of more collaborative, shared ways of thriving. And I think the mycorrhizal fungi from recent research really offer us a bit of a non-extractive, non-hierarchical model of distribution where resources are shared based on need rather than individual sort of accumulation. So the way that this shows up is that if the fungi, for example, weren't there, the mycorrhizal fungi weren't involved in this relationship, and the plants weren't connected to each other through the Wood Wide Web, then what might happen is that certain trees might be hoarding loads of the nutrients, or there might be accumulation of certain nutrients in one part of the forest but not another. Whereas as soon as you start to look at the mycorrhizal fungi, they're helping to move around the nutrients in a way that's sort of shared and equitable. Yeah, I really thought this lent itself to a framework that I think is quite abolitionist, and abolition is just the idea that we can live in a world that moves beyond sort of prisons and policing and surveillance, and more towards one that's built on community and safety and care and well-being for all of us. And so yeah, I really like the fact that...
Dean
To be honest, it really gets to the heart of a lot of my practice with leading walks and workshops with other folks and really creating spaces that we can slow down and just take a moment to breathe. Because it sounds like something small, but it's actually, I think, really profound what impact it can have when we slow down. And I definitely feel that our world today is really driven by speed and productivity and extraction in many ways, and that doesn't really allow us to take time to listen to our bodies or to take the time to slow down and to breathe. And I think that kind of leads to a worldwide ungroundedness and sort of untetheredness, where we're kind of just on a hamster wheel constantly thinking how we can kind of keep going and going. And I don't think that really matches with our sort of body's rhythms, but it also doesn't match with the natural rhythms, the rhythms of the seasons, which at sort of the autumn and winter time does slow down, because that quiet moment is what allows for spring and summer, which are much more sort of, I guess, for lack of a better word, productive times of year, where things are growing and sort of thriving in a more external, outward way. If we don't allow for that attention and sort of headspace to slow down, then I don't think we really have the time to then respond in caring ways. I think it leads to more reactiveness, and it doesn't really foster a sort of culture where we can nurture and not consume. It kind of just encourages that we keep going and going until we all unfortunately kind of feel very burnt out and not in line with ourselves. And so more and more I think about how a lot of the sort of harm that's happening in the world comes back to a lack of groundedness and a lack of sort of awareness of what is sort of going on internally or with our own bodies. And I think, yeah, a lot of wisdom comes from slowing down, and that's what really creates the space to show up for others, as Dean Spade mentions in that quote. Showing up for others isn't easy as well. It's an important thing to remember that community can sound quite romanticized, but actually it can be really difficult to show up for each other when we're struggling ourselves. And so taking a bit of time to allow for what shows up in our bodies and giving that the time and space and care that that deserves, I think will lead us to a much more fruitful and grounded place as a society. Yeah, I think in answering this question, it feels really important to kind of recognize that we are in a sort of political, social moment, which really does feel very heavy. There's this kind of antidote in my mind, which is to try and find ways of connecting more deeply with the natural world. And that has served me so well in recent years as kind of a way of grounding and reconnecting to what's important. But I think also it's important to remember that we're kind of in a time of climate destruction and ecological collapse in many ways. And so the more that we kind of find ourselves disconnected, the more that that facilitates exploitation in my mind, whether that's of the living world or of other humans in some cases. So when we feel untethered from the living world, I think it becomes easier to treat whole ecosystems and each other really as disposable. Whereas when we restore connection, I think that nurtures a lot more empathy and accountability and a shared sense of responsibility for the planet and for each other. And it helps us to recognize that, you know, harm is one part of a system that reverberates everywhere. You can hurt one part and it actually hurts all of us. And so, yeah, with my work with foraging, leading herbalism walks and plant and fungi walks, especially with multiply marginalized communities like people of color and black people, disabled folks, refugees, asylum seekers, it really creates these spaces where we can connect with plants, but not just as other species, but really as companions. And I think that helps us to foster a greater sense of belonging in the natural world. And it just really allows for reconnection, which I think is our fuel in many ways to getting out of some of the really difficult situations that we're in now with climate change and climate destruction. So I think reconnection has to be the way forward. I think capitalist logic can be found throughout the way that we interact with the natural world. I feel like capitalism goes very much hand in hand with colonialism as well. So it's kind of both of those two forces that I think really drive, unfortunately, the exploitation that I say we, but not really all humans, but the sort of situation that humans find themselves in of exploitation of the natural world, such as deforestation in the rainforests and just really seeing living systems as commodities. It really reduces living systems as kind of resources and metrics for extraction. So forests that are so complex and sort of living systems of their own become timber, soil becomes just yield, land becomes property. And then this kind of mirrors the sort of colonial carceral logics that we have of people as well. So we then start to see our own bodies and labor and our lives as data points and assets or liabilities. And it kind of all becomes very soulless very quickly. And as a really great thinker, Angela Davis, reminds us, the systems of domination are interconnected with each other. So really the devaluation of nature becomes like completely inseparable from the devaluation of certain lives and certain communities. So I think to challenge one without the other, like to challenge just sort of systems of domination in the human world without the non-human world, kind of misses the roots of the problem. Because I think, unfortunately, yeah, when we are just thinking of ourselves and not kind of the natural world and how entangled we all are together, that kind of furthers this logic that actually humans are dominating nature. And that's what has got us into the situation of climate change that we're in now. Also, there's a sort of capitalist narrative that runs through the way that we see the natural world sometimes as just being a place of competition. And I think a lot of my work thinks about actually it's not just competition that shows up in the natural world, but also there are these instances of cooperation and interconnectedness. And so, yeah, just trying to think more about the different narratives that could be present in the natural world rather than just one size fits all, where it's kind of like this dog eat dog world and everything is just survival of the fittest. There should be space for that narrative. There are some instances where we see different animal species maybe competing, including ourselves, but I do think there should be more space for thinking about the non-competitive, more cooperative ways of being as well, and what that can teach us about being within all of these sort of relationships within the natural world.
As Maimana mentioned, capitalist economic ideology and imperialism have separated humans from the natural world and our experience and sense of relatedness with it. Practicing a decolonial approach to nature connection, then, is key to healing this disconnect. I asked Maimana what this looks like in her work.
I think, unfortunately, decolonization and being decolonial has become a little bit of a buzzword. And so I really try and think about what does that actually look like for me? How does that manifest in the work that I do? And instead of going with the status quo and kind of just going with this idea of land ownership and mastery, we can listen to the many sort of different ancestral indigenous ways of relating to the land. And that often looks like thinking about the land as kin instead of capital. And in many of the plant and fungi walks that I facilitate now, we very deliberately move away from the sort of Latin taxonomical approach, which this sort of naming system that comes from European colonization, where we came up with particular Latin names for all of plants and all of animals that they interacted with. And I often in my walks kind of move away from those because I think that prioritizes just a very cognitive way of relating to the world, whereas we can actually learn a lot through our bodies and through experiential knowledge. And so when we meet plants as other living beings that we can relate to in a more rich way than just thinking about what their particular Latin name might be, I think we honour what people already know and feel in their bodies. And that can be a much more sort of holistic way of viewing not only the plants and fungi that we meet, but also ourselves. It kind of gives ourselves more scope to connect more deeply. And I think this is really important because colonial frames sort of really erased our lived experiences and cultural knowledges. Lots of parts of the world that colonizers sort of visited on their voyages, which were often very sort of destructive and not kind of in keeping with natural rhythms, but just thinking about what could be taken from particular parts of the land. I think we should try and replace that with non-extractive ways of being with the natural world. And often that looks like reciprocity. The natural world already gives us so much, to thinking about what we can give back to the natural world too, and sort of our plant and fungal ancestors. So I often try and teach people to kind of think more about these exchanges rather than just a one-way sort of system of extraction, which I think the colonial view really models. I really like to create sort of spaces that are as much as possible quite non-hierarchical, where it's not just me sharing knowledge, but also my participants who come along are also or really invited to share what they know from their own cultural traditions and histories. And I find it really beautiful to see when you kind of model different forms of education where it's not just one person sharing all of their knowledge, but it's kind of more communal, you really get just such a richness of different perspectives. And I've worked a lot with really young children, but also with elders and over 65s. And it's just kind of creating these intergenerational spaces of learning that really keep me grounded myself and kind of remind me that there is so much more to know about the natural world from different traditions and different cultures. I remember like once leading a walk with over 65s where everyone started off by saying that they didn't know much about the natural world, and then by the end of it everyone was sharing their recipes and their different herbal sort of remedies and all sorts. So it kind of, I really like to subvert with my work what we think of as expertise and kind of reminding ourselves that we actually all have different forms of very valid knowledge that we can share with one another. And so yeah, walking with plants and fungi almost becomes a way of practicing mutual aid, because we're kind of observing together, we're naming feelings and patterns, we're teaching each other about different methods of healing through the plants and through the fungi. Medicinal plants and fungi just hold such amazing lessons. We can learn so much from them in terms of our own bodies and in terms of our health. And I think that can be really deeply empowering. So not to kind of replace clinical medicine, I do say that as a caveat, because I think both can really coexist with one another. But at the moment, it can be really hard, especially for multiply marginalized communities, to access healthcare that feels culturally relevant. And also as a disabled person, it can be really hard in the NHS to navigate the healthcare system. So having some of that knowledge held within the communities that we live in feels really important. And I'm always really clear that I'm not a qualified medical herbalist, but I hold that boundary really carefully in the spaces that I facilitate. And what I'm interested in is not necessarily, you know, prescription, but increasing our ability to feel well in the modern day world, really going back to our roots and remembering that actually a lot of the plants that can heal us are just in our surroundings. And so that can be really empowering for people that come to the walks and workshops, where they realize that actually, for example, a dandelion that's kind of pushing up through the cracks of the pavement is a forageable weed, and learning the different plants around us that have such rich histories of healing with humans, even in this part of the world where we often don't kind of connect with a lot of the folklore of this particular part of the world. But I think it's really important to engage with the sort of medical lineages that plants hold through folklore, through ancestral knowledge, through lived experience. And again, shifting from plants being inert resources, instead being fellow living collaborators. And that can be really transformative. So teaching people how to forage safely, how to recognize, respect and approach plants and fungi with care, I think that can subtly but really powerfully shift the dynamics of knowledge and authority within healthcare systems. And it invites people to trust their capacity to nourish themselves, to learn to recognize the same plant over time, and in some cases to support their bodies in sort of gentle preventative ways. This is a bit of a carry on. space. And so I really feel like the impact that I've seen so far has been sometimes subtle, but quite profound as well, because people are noticing things that they had previously really overlooked. They're feeling less alone in their grief and their curiosity. And they're beginning to relate to the land as not just like a backdrop or a resource, but as a living collaborator, which is really special to see as a facilitator. And I know that definitely over the years, many participants have told me that, you know, the experiences of being on walks or workshops with me has shifted a little bit how they move through the world, with kind of more care and humility with the natural world and a deeper sense of responsibility to the places that they inhabit, which I think is really special, because in growing up in a city, it can be, yeah, as we know, quite lonely and quite disconnected. And so providing spaces that provide or model an alternative feels really special. And so I hope with Fungi Futures that the next few years that are ahead, I can kind of continue to help model conditions of collective reimagining and really thinking about dreaming and what that looks like for the future society that we build together. And yeah, just thinking about this project.
Central to Maimana's work is the cultivation of community capacity and hope. When reading Maimana's thesis, I was reminded of the abolitionist thinker Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Gilmore says that abolition is life in rehearsal. Put simply, she argues that if we live and act how we think, how we want the world to be, we are changing it, action by action, day by day.
It's difficult sometimes to find hope in the world that we live in, with so many sort of injustices that are really staring us in the face. Immediately comes to mind that it's difficult to hope when there are ongoing genocides in Palestine, in Sudan, across the world. There are just so many real injustices coming up in Congo as well, and Kashmir, and kind of the more that you think of yourself as a citizen in the world, as a global citizen, the more that you kind of realize that all we really have is each other, and our connections with each other are just so important in these times. And coming together as communities feels really important to cultivate hope, because as Maryam Kaba says, hope isn't a sort of passive emotion. It's not just a passive optimism. It's daily embodied work. It's listening, building relationships, caring in very sort of material, concrete ways. And it's trying to sustain the joy even in times of hardship. And a friend of mine who was really beloved to me, who passed away last year, called Claudia Manchanda, she often was someone that taught me a lot about how to hope in these times of destruction and collapse and hardship. And it's kind of something that I realize must be prioritized in our work as community organizers, as artists, as scientists. I think it's so important that all of us remember that it's not going to be easy to hope sometimes, but it's something that we need to really try and consciously cultivate together, because I think hope is the fuel in many ways that allows us to create new conditions. And I think, again, thinking back to my practice of relating with fungi and with plants, it's a reminder to people that we are so interconnected, and not just as a theory, but as a sort of lived experience. It opens up space for us to imagine and embody futures that are more aligned with the planetary rhythms and with nature and with our own sort of collective agency in allowing us to flourish, rather than the sort of scarcity mindset that comes about from capitalism.
I hope you enjoyed this thoughtful episode with Maimana. If you want to join in on one of her plant and fungi walks, head to her Instagram at fungi.futures. Next week, I'll be speaking with Nathan Miller from East London Waterworks Park and Leslie Barson of Granville Community Kitchen, where we'll learn about community-led projects that are reimagining social infrastructures, public space, and our food system. Thank you for listening. Beneath the City of Soil was created and produced by me, Robin Moffat, with the support of Transmission Roundhouse.